It's the Media Roundtable on Your Call. Good morning. I'm Angie Cuero. In last night's State of the Union address, President Joe Biden shunned any pretense that he was giving anything other than a campaign speech, and it was a barn burner. He wasn't slow to invoke Adolf Hitler, apparently acknowledging the fears of those comparing our times to Weimar Germany. He couched that in references to Franklin Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, and Ronald Reagan. Then it was off to the races for the rest of the hour. Let's go over what was in that speech with two returning guests. It is always a pleasure to bring on board journalists John Nichols and Will Bunch. John, Will, welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Angie.
Sure. John is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of several books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. And he has written with Senator Bernie Sanders, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and the national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's written several books on politics, including his most recent, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. And we're going to go to the State of the Union in just a moment, but first we're going to honor our tradition of highlighting good journalism. So, Will, I'll start with you. What work stood out in the positive for you this past week?
Yeah, you know, I was really impressed by The Intercept and the work that they've been doing, kind of picking apart a key element of the New York Times' coverage of the conflict between Israel and Hamas. So basically, we're talking about media criticism in a sense. But, you know, one of the most critical stories the Times produced was one accusing Hamas of kind of a systematic pattern of sexual assaults on October 7th. Mm-hmm. And it's a very complicated story because I think almost everybody agrees that sexual assaults did occur that day. It's a ugly part of war, and certainly Hamas seems to participate in it. A UN report confirmed that. But the New York Times did some very strange practices with its major story on the topic. It employed a freelancer with no experience, with a filmmaker with past ties to Israeli intelligence.
Oh, dear.
Who admitted in a podcast about how she produced the story that all of the, like, normal, most reliable sources that she went to initially had no examples of sexual assaults. And then only then she turned to these very politicized and groups with not very good track records on the truth. That supplied her with some people. And some of these anecdotes they use in the story have kind of unraveled to some degree. You know, one key witness says things didn't happen the way it was reported in the story. Another kibbutz where there supposedly were assaults, you know, leaders of the kibbutz say there were no assaults. Mm. And, you know, this is such a wretching conflict to begin with. And we just need the best information, especially from the most trusted sources like the New York Times. So I really applaud The Intercept for digging into this, and they've been relying on some initial groundbreaking work by some other sites whom they've acknowledged. But, you know, it's important because we've lost a lot of our media watchdogs, and this work is just so important.
Yeah, absolutely. John, how about you?
Well, I would echo Will's very wise mention and very appropriate mention of what The Intercept has done. And I have another Gaza story, but not you know, such a big one in some ways, but maybe one that is of significant consequence. And that's from Al Jazeera. And the headline on the piece was Minnesota's Stunning Uncommitted Vote Reveals Enduring Problem for Biden. And it's a piece on the Minnesota primary, which didn't get a whole bunch of attention. It was one of the many Super Tuesday primaries. But in Minnesota, which is a kind of often unnoted swing state, it's a state that Trump came within 42,000 votes of winning in 2016. And it's a competitive state. In Minnesota, in the primary there, almost 20% of the voters voted uncommitted to send the president a message about Gaza. And this is part of a pattern. It started in Michigan, of course, where you had 13% vote uncommitted. But and folks thought, well, you know, that's just Michigan. It has a very, very large Muslim American, Arab American population. That must explain it. But now this uncommitted movement has moved out of Michigan to Minnesota, where it got a higher percentage of the vote and actually won 11 delegates to the Democratic National Convention. And then a day later in Hawaii, it got an even higher percentage of the vote, almost 30%, and won 7 delegates. And so I think there's when we pick these stories, I try to pick a story that maybe people haven't been following as closely as they should. And it does strike me that this uncommitted movement has become, not as an individual, but as an idea, the primary challenger to Joe Biden in the primaries. And so, again, the Al Jazeera piece, Minnesota's stunning uncommitted vote reveals enduring problem for Biden. And that was written by Joe Stepanski. And it's a good analysis with a lot of depth on, you know, why A, the uncommitted movement is out there, and B, why it's got a real likelihood to continue to grow.
And it's
gonna can I just say real quickly?
Yeah, sure.
Because, I actually wrote one of my columns this week about.
So did I.
Yeah, we're both following this. We're both animated by the same thing, I guess. But I just want to say, and maybe it can serve as a segue into us talking about the State of the Union speech. But part of the point of my column is I do think you're seeing a response to these votes from the Biden administration. You know, and look at the State of the Union last night, where, you know, he announced this elaborate new port operation to try and get goods into Gaza. You know, now I agree with a lot of the activists who say we really could and should be doing a lot more than that, you know, that we could, you know, be pressuring them with arms restrictions and that sort of thing. But I think there's been a marked shift in tone from the Biden administration that's really accelerated in the last 2 weeks since that vote in Michigan. And then, as John said, you had the votes in Minnesota and Hawaii. And I really think the Biden administration is adjusting its message, at least, and maybe some of its actual policies to respond to this, which is great. I mean, that's what democracy is all about, you know.
Yeah.
The people can organize a movement and go to the polls and see an actual influence on policymakers. I mean, that's exactly what's supposed to happen.
And so, no longer dismissible as a fringe at that point.
No, and one thing I'll just add, throw into the mix there. Well, I agree with Will, and as I said, we wrote similar columns this week. Yeah. But I doubt that anything that the administration's doing at this point is going to slow down the uncommitted vote. I've just finished a piece, a survey from around the country on what's going on with this, and it's booming. Right. There are new movements starting in state after state in Georgia and Washington state around the country. And I think that one of the challenges with Gaza, and this is a challenge for Biden, and we're going to speak in a moment about, I think, how well Biden did with his State of the Union address. So this is not all bashing on him.
Right.
But one of the challenges, I think, is that the base voters of the Democratic Party have become very sophisticated on the issue of Gaza and on the issue of Israel and Palestine. And I think they know what they want, or at least a substantial portion do, and that is a permanent ceasefire and a halt to U.S. military aid to Israel, at least a halt to increases in U.S. military aid. And I don't think the Biden administration is going to do that. And so as a result, I think you are going to continue to see a significant increase in this uncommitted vote, and ultimately it would be difficult for it to become, you know, a major factor at the Democratic National Convention. I think with an inside-outside presence, it could be something significant that's coming. And I think that's why both Will and I are highlighting this as you know, kind of a somewhat hidden story that could become a very, very big deal unless the Biden administration makes a very significant shift in policy.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to watch. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's got kind of a 1968 almost feel to it, you know, when Eugene McCarthy that year shocked the Democratic establishment at, you know, seemingly out of nowhere at first. I mean, I think the difference here is, you know, it's a little bit harder to rally people for, quote, uncommitted, unquote, than for an actual human, even a diffident one like Eugene McCarthy. But number one, but you know, and also that, you know, there is kind of a late start in this accelerated primary system that's nothing like the primitive primary system that existed in 1968. But I think there are a lot of similarities in, you know, progressives in the Democratic Party trying to send a message to the establishment. It's very similar.
We're going to get into the rest of the speech as well. That speech was long, as they always are. Yes. So we're not going to get into the whole thing, obviously. Yeah. But I do want to touch on something that the press has just been relentless. And the New York Times, I'm talking to you, about the president's age. The Times did it again in the very first sentence of its first post-speech bulletin. It said it was a forceful case that he was fit enough for another 4 years. And that's been the bang. You know, is he fit? Is he too old? Do you think he finally put that to rest, John?
No. Mm. I mean, of course not. You know, if a State of the Union address could put it to rest, it would have happened last year when he gave a very muscular State of the Union address. Mm. The fact of the matter is that there has been and will continue to be a relentless effort to say that Joe Biden is not up to the job, right? That is a Republican strategy. Right. I mean, it's very conscious. They've been working it very hard and in their sort of media bubble for a long time. But B, it is also a genuine concern of the American people, whether you like it or not. Polling shows that, you know, there's a lot of folks who are concerned about, you know, whether somebody who's would finish their term, you know, not in their early 80s, but actually moving into their late 80s.
Right.
Is up to that. And so that's a legitimate discussion. It's fine. Biden's job, which I think he did very well last night, is to continually establish that he is up for it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is Will just mentioned democracy. This is democracy at core, right? You go out and you don't tell people what you are or what you're going to do. You show them.
Right.
And last night, Joe Biden showed them. It was a stellar and I don't say this cynically or critically. It was a stellar performance. He went up there and he didn't just deliver the speech. He was anticipating and ready for the Republican interruptions, the failures to applaud, all of those things. And in real time, he responded to that. He seemed very dynamic, very on top of things. I mean, it was just what he needed to do. That won't make them stop saying he's too old.
Right.
But if he keeps doing that throughout the campaign, it's going to have a significant impact. It will move numbers. And I'll just give you the last note. There was a focus group polling that I think showed a 19% shift from before the speech to after the speech among people asked, you know, did they think he was up for it, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so the answer to your question, Angie, is that if Biden keeps doing this and does it a lot, comes to a lot of states, comes to Pennsylvania, comes to Wisconsin, comes to places across this country, works hard and shows, you know, this level of skill, this level of competence, this issue will ultimately go away. But it won't go away from one speech. It's kind of a, you know, this is what a campaign is about. You do it again and again and again.
Right. Your own relentless drumbeat. Absolutely.
Yes.
Will, I want to take this over to you, and that is what John mentioned about the GOP heckling. He was clearly ready for that, but he also, sometimes the vibe is as important as the words. And the vibe that I picked up was that this was a chance for Joe Biden to show he has a sense of humor and that he has a little superiority. He reminded me of a cat owner playing with a string, you know, kind of dangling a string in the cat's face and waiting for him to swat at it, but being totally ready for what that cat was going to do. Will, let me get your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, you want to play to your strengths in politics. And it's interesting because, I mean, clearly, and we've seen this before last night, but we definitely saw it last night. That unscripted moment, that back and forth, that's something that he just shines at. You know, I mean, so many of the problems he's experienced, you know, in the last couple of years with people saying that he's lost a few steps, usually involve him, you know, reading from a teleprompter, right? And trying to give a scripted speech and somehow he says the wrong words, or it seems like a lot of times he'll like loses place in the teleprompter. But, you know, when he's in this kind of back and forth scenario, he's as sharp as he probably was when he was, you know, 35 years old, you know. He's really good at it. And it was interesting. I had heard a couple TV reports before the speech that Mike Johnson was out there telling, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greene types in his caucus, hey, you know, cool it with the cat calls and that sort of thing. And honestly, I don't think he really cares about the decorum of the House that much, although he probably should. But but I think it was really just because he knows that politically that's a losing game for them, that Biden is great, you know, at that type of moment, you know, and it really excelled, you know. And yeah, you know, in his own way, and it was good. I think, you know, without copying what Ronald Reagan famously did in 1984, because, you know, those of us like me and John who actually remember that campaign.
And know, me, yeah, me too.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. So you remember that his first debate, he did pretty badly, and he actually lost his place in his closing monologue and started rambling, and people, you know, luckily for Reagan, probably we didn't have Twitter and stuff back then, but to the effect that people could react, they were like, my God, he's really aged in 4 years as president. And is he up for another term? It's like, my God, he's 73 years old. You know, that seemed ancient in 1984. And, you know, he famously came out in that second debate and said, you know, I don't want age to be an issue in this campaign. I'm not going to make an issue out of my opponent's youth and inexperience. And everybody laughed, and that was it. And you know, in that one quip, you know, the Gipper, you know, put it all to rest. And Biden didn't exactly do that. But I do think, look, you know, as all of us get older, you know, we know that there are disadvantages to getting older, but there's also a couple of advantages, which is just kind of the wisdom and maybe the patience and understanding that you develop that maybe when you were a younger hothead, you didn't have, you know. And I think Biden kind of addressed that. You know, he said, you know, he's been called too young and he's been called too old. And the truth is he's seen some things, you know, and he's learned so much about America over this long career that he's had. And that was a pretty impressive message. You know, I think that's when it comes to age, I think that's the best messaging he can put out there. And, you know, I agree with John that I don't think he put it to rest. He's never, you know, especially in this kind of environment, he's never going to put it to rest. You know, I mean, you know, he's not an Obama style or a Bill Clinton style public speaker. He never has been, even when he was near 50, right? You know, and so, you know, and you know, he, you know, at times his volume and kind of pacing was, you know, a little, you know, was definitely not the way Obama would have delivered it, right? You know, and you know, and then there were people online saying, you know, why is Biden yelling at me, you know? And I mean, he can't win, whatever, you know. It's like, first they were saying that he was not energetic enough, then last night they're saying the guy's too energetic, because that's how it works. They're going to find, they're, you know, they're going to find something to criticize, and they do, and they did, you know. So he's never going to put the age issue to rest, because, you know, in the Fox News age, that's just never going to happen. But he clearly did as best as he could with these issues.
You know, there are some things people were listening for and some that were unexpected. If you were listening for the word abortion, you were disappointed. That word never came out of his mouth. He did kind of back into the topic. He started out with IVF, and then he moved on to dismantling Roe v. Wade, and he did bring up a very sympathetic person who needed to get an abortion because of the state of the fetus. But, you know, of course he didn't mention a woman who just wants an abortion. That wasn't going to come out of his mouth. And I think what also people might have been surprised at was the fact that he referred to a person as an illegal. And that was not in the original transcript. That was in a response to Marjorie Taylor Greene in the audience. But he quickly countered that. He called other criminals legals. So let's put those two, let's split those two in half. John, let's talk about the abortion issue there. How effective was he at splitting the difference? Splitting the difference between people who were opposed and didn't want to hear about abortions and people who were waiting for him to please just say the word.
Well, people who are opposed and don't want to hear about abortions aren't going to vote for Joe Biden anyway, so it didn't matter.
That's true.
This is an inside Joe Biden's head sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. He came up in an era when Democrats kind of avoided the issue of abortion. So the imprint, the political imprint on his head is one of kind of dancing around the issue, right?
Yeah.
You know, collecting the votes, hopefully, but not really emphasizing it. That's the politics of the past. That's the politics of the maybe the 80s, some of the 90s, you know, where Clinton was running around with the term safe, legal, and rare. Mm-hmm. You know, and so this is one of Biden's big problems across the board. It's a real, real challenge for him. He kind of got his political imprint in the 1970s and maybe 1980s a little bit. And he hasn't really broken out of it. So even though he is, as we're saying, a competent communicator, did a good job last night, there are just certain places he doesn't go. It's outside of his comfort zone. And you can read into it whatever you want, you know, his own background, things like that. Or I think more importantly, it's just where he came up politically. And so people are always going to be disappointed if they want him to give a full-throated speech on abortion rights. Mm-hmm. That's going to come from Kamala Harris. I interviewed her this week, and she was incredibly strong on the issue, you know, detailed and personal and thoughtful. And, you know, I think what's going to happen politically is the Democrats are going to put Harris way up front on abortion rights issues. She's going to talk about them a lot. Biden will do what you saw last night. He will reference. It will be probably sufficient, but not that sort of impassioned messaging that you like. And again, I would just emphasize, this is the way to understand Joe Biden, who I've covered for a very long time and recognize as a very skilled politician. But his one weakness, his deep weakness, is that he can't kind of break out of the moment in which he came into politics. And you see this on the issue of abortion rights, speaking about it, speaking more bluntly on it. You see it on Gaza because, I mean, I think his mentality was shaped in the 1970s and he just struggles to get beyond that.
That's a really interesting take, John. That really is. Yeah. And we're going to go to... We'll go to Will on that in just a second, but I want to slide Robert in here before the half. Robert is calling in from San Francisco. Robert, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question or comment.
My comment is very simple. I don't see you discussing the relevant issues of why the average voter would vote for Mr. Biden. Is he 32 years old? Is he 6'2"? Is he an athlete on my winning team? And does he look like your favorite movie star? That's the average voter. And they could care less whether whatever he did or what he didn't do or what his policies are, because no one even knows what that means in the first place. I'm talking about our average voter, which is several millions of people.
Robert, do you think it makes a difference that they don't have that option to vote for anyone who's 35 and looks like a movie star?
That's all they're looking for. Trump looks younger. I vote for him. He's on my team. I vote for him. He says he's angry. I vote for him. What does he do? I don't know. What position did he hold? You're lucky if the average voter even knows that he was president, what position he held. And that's the sad state of affairs.
It is. Robert, you're depressing me.
Can I just caution a little bit there?
Yeah, please.
I understand Robert's point, and I think there's some validity to it. But the truth of the matter is that the voters who really don't get it don't vote. I mean, that's about, you know, roughly 40 to 50% of voters or potential voters in America don't cast ballots. The people who cast ballots tend to know, you know, why they're there and what they're there about. The challenge is, though, that they're so locked. They now, maybe challenge, maybe good, but they're so locked into their silos that they don't get out of them, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's very little you can say to a core Republican voter that's going to make them move, right? Yeah. And there's very little you can say to a core Democratic voter that's going to make them move. And so I think it isn't so much ignorance as it is, you know, just an intransigence, refusal to kind of entertain a discussion that might take you to a place where you're not comfortable. And that's no more of a compliment. I'm not suggesting the electorate is, you know, where it ought to be or, you know, approaching things as they should be approached. But I think that's the reality we have to understand. And the way to break out of that if it is possible at all. The way to break out of that, I have to be very honest with you, has nothing to do with the politicians, and it has to be do with the renewal of local media in the United States. Mm. We have an obliterated local media system in the United States. It virtually does not exist. We don't have news deserts around the country. We have one big news desert, the whole country. And why I emphasize that is people just are not – for an awful lot of Americans, they're no longer in that sort of nuanced discussion at a level that where they live about politics. What they're getting is an input from Washington and from maybe New York a little bit, but primarily from Washington that is very – it's hyper – managed, it's hyper propagandized, and as a result, you just don't have the fluidity that we used to have in our politics.
Yeah, Will, I'm throwing so much at you for your last comment, but we didn't give you a chance to address the use of the word illegals, the idea of abortion. Now we're talking about how the consumer, if you want to use that word, looks at the choices they have, Biden and Trump. I'll let you pick and choose what you want to address in your last few comments.
Well, one thing I know there's that. And then as John spoke, I kept thinking, oh, I got to respond to that. And then he said something even more insightful. It's like, no, I should respond to that. So, but one thing, John touched on, I think the caller actually mentioned it as one of his things too, is about the tribalism, it's interesting because it really gets back to the very beginning of the show when John and I were both talking about Gaza and the uncommitted movement, but, you see on certain issues, and Gaza's the biggest one, that like there's a whole crew of people, and this might be too broad or unfair, but I kind of call them MSNBC Democrats, because the stereotype is the kind of person who maybe they're a boomer or they're in the older half of the Democratic electorate. They're very engaged around politics, but their engagement is largely around, their hatred of Donald Trump, which is totally earned, in my opinion, but, and winning, that only beating the Republicans matters. And it's like being a sports fan. And so, you're not going to criticize the referee's obvious bad call that benefits your sports team. You become very afraid of saying things that you probably should be saying, and on Gaza, if you say, oh, it's great that uncommitted, they're sending a message to Biden and you get all these angry responses of, they're only helping Trump. This is only helping Trump or anything that, it's not that we should try and influence Biden to make him a better president. It's, by opposing him on any issue, you're helping Trump. And look, I think people, progressive minded people should be pressuring Biden on a couple issues right now. Gaza is one of them. Another is immigration. I'm very concerned that he's, going into the election a little bit too quick to adopt what I call these Trump light immigration policies, but this type of voter that I call the MSNBC Democrat, any criticism of Biden is going to help Trump, and it's really bad for our politics, and it's really stifling. And
that's where we got to leave it, guys. I'm sorry. We've got Akbar Shahid Ahmed is in the background. So we're going to go ahead and switch over to Gaza for the rest of our hour. It's always a joy to have you both. And I thank you, John Nichols, Will Bunch. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much, Angie.
Thanks, Angie. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And you're listening to Your Call on KALW. We'll be talking about Gaza for the balance of the hour. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we'll be opening the phones on Gaza shortly after we introduce our next guest here on Your Call. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Angie Carter in for Rose Aguilar today. We're going to continue our analysis of the State of the Union. We're moving our focus now to Israel and Gaza. President Biden spoke for about 6 minutes on the topic, dealing with the horror there, the ongoing human tragedy. The U.S. has been immovable up to now in its support for Israel. But protesters, as you heard in the last half of the show, have been following President Biden. In fact, last night, hundreds of them near the Capitol laid out a flag the size of a swimming pool, a Palestinian flag across the avenue. They had signs that said Biden's legacy is genocide and end the occupation. Democrats, too, have been pleading with him to change course on Gaza. So what impact did his comments make? Did he address this to a point that we really think he's going to take even a slightly different tack? We're going to bring in Akbar Shahid Ahmed. He is the senior diplomatic correspondent for Huffington Post, based in Washington, D.C. I can't urge you enough to read his post. These injured Palestinians made it out of Gaza. Their loved ones did not, and the distance is agony. That's at HuffPost. Akbar, it's really good to have you here.
Thanks a lot, Angie. It's good to be here.
I want to start with that column, which is so important. Tell me about the people that you talk to.
Absolutely. I was in Qatar last week interviewing some of the tiny, tiny fraction of wounded people in Gaza who have been able to make it out for medically essential surgeries. And the stories you hear are heartbreaking, right? I mean, the term family separation in the U.S. is something we unfortunately have had to come to understand in recent years. And the separation that these families are going through is an indescribable agony, right? They are trying to heal. They're getting surgeries to deal with amputations, to deal with shrapnel lodged in their limbs in a totally new country, a place they've never been, while their loved ones, right, their children, their spouses, their parents are still stuck in an active war zone, a place where there is now mass starvation occurring. There's ongoing bombardment. There's a spread of disease. And talking to these people, Angie, was extremely enlightening. It was, I wish it was something more people in this country had the opportunity to do, because it's only through understanding the real toll of this war, right? No one here was relitigating October 7th or the undeniable atrocities that occurred there, right? When this war began, Hamas led this attack into Israel. No one is talking about, oh, we're defending that, or we're justifying that. They're just saying, we're apart from our loved ones. They're at risk. All we want is for the fighting to end so we can all start to heal.
It's interesting to think about leaving your children behind. You can see adults being parted from each other and having the wherewithal to deal with that, but I'm stuck on the word you used when you said people leaving their children behind. Are there any avenues of contact whatsoever, or do they just have to wait and see how their own children are doing?
It's extremely challenging, and I think it's important for people to understand there are currently, that really does only one exit point for actual human beings out of Gaza right now, right, which is into Egypt. Now, both Israel and Egypt, and to some extent Hamas, very tightly control that crossing. And that's why these people have been separated from their children, because even wounded people who've been moved out for essential surgeries, right, otherwise they die, have only been allowed to bring at most one companion. Maybe if they have very young infant children, they can bring them. Mm-hmm. But that still means you're leaving behind your 10-year-old, your 12-year-old. And in the instance of men in particular, as we know, Israeli forces have been seeing all Palestinian men really over the age of 10 or 12 as potential combatants, right? So you're leaving behind your sons and maybe your husband, your brother, in a very potentially dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. What did you hear as you heard Biden's take on Gaza last night? Let me get your overall impression first.
I think it's clear that, look, President Biden's record is of someone with personal tragedy, empathy for human suffering. I think in the last 2 to 3 weeks, shockingly, 30,000 people dead on the low end, you've finally seen the Biden administration wake up to the human toll of the policy they've perpetuated. But even now, Angie, we're not seeing the U.S. surge aid. We're seeing a lot of what one U.S. official I spoke with described as low yield, hard to do PR stunts, right? So we're talking here about airdrops, many of which are not well distributed once the aid lands. Now we're talking about this kind of really out there idea of a maritime aid supply, which in a scenario where it's an inaccessible place, right, or it's an enemy country on the other side, you cannot get in. Syria comes to mind, right? The U.S. had very limited ability to get aid in Syria. Mm-hmm. But right now we're talking about all the land routes into Gaza, and I've been to Gaza, I've reported from there, I've been through the Israeli crossing into Gaza. Israel controls, right, something upwards of 80% of Gaza's borders. So if this U.S. ally, Israel, wanted to, they could search Aiden. And so while the president in the State of the Union and recent remarks has said, I'm shifting, I hear you, I'm moving, it's nowhere near soon enough.
I want to bring everyone who's listening into our conversation right now. Akbar is going to take your questions and calls. He's quite the resource. If you're working to understand what's happening in Gaza, or you already have your own firm opinions and questions, we'd love to hear from you right now. Our phone lines are open. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. We'll also watch our emails, so you can drop us a line. Your call at kalw.org. We're going to start things out with Adam, who's calling in from San Francisco. Adam, I appreciate your waiting. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. I just like to say that I like to talk about Gaza, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the lowest points in humanity ever. Hitler murdered 7 million innocent Jews, 6 or 7 million Jews, but that was done in the dark. Nobody's watching. The whole world now is watching this horrible kids, children, women, men getting shredded in pieces by bombs supplied by Biden. Biden lost his humanity. The whole world lost its humanity. This is unbelievable. Many of us cannot even have food, eat. What, you know, just having that in our mind. This is crazy. And it was a short time. Yes, Gaza is, the Gaza civilians are, you know, suffering a lot. The fact is, Many of the others don't know that Netanyahu played a big role in creating Hamas. This thing was created, this incident, October 7th, very suspicious.
Well, actually, let me take this. There's something very interesting in what you're saying there, and that is, if we can touch specifically on this, Akbar, and that is the passion that we're hearing. And I think there's a real disconnect between some people who have no idea what's going on there in the U.S. and those who do have this passionate engagement with what's happening there and are really watching every step with Joe Biden. Did President Biden bring more people into the know last night? Did he give an explanation of what was happening, or was he just soft pedaling it a little too much because, of course, Israel doesn't want its toes stepped on?
I think that's a great point. I think there's there are segments of the population, and I think it's important to remember that segment is not just necessarily Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. It's resonating with a lot of people of color, with a lot of younger voters, but we're still talking about a minority of the general U.S. population that's deeply engaged in this war. I think for President Biden, who's now 6 months away from re-election, right, or his hope of re-election, this is not a winning issue. He doesn't want to be talking about this. He doesn't want to be asked about it, nor do his aides. I think their hope is a kind of band-aid approach, right, to your point and to Adam's point as well. Given the extent to which we're seeing images, video, just so much evidence of suffering, I think the Biden administration's main goal right now is to stem that flow a little bit, right, and to kind of change the strategic communications picture, which from a moral standpoint, of course, is dubious. I'd argue from a strategic standpoint, Adam also mentioned a really good point, which is this deep disillusionment and disdain for not just Biden, but the U.S. that's coming in this moment. And I heard this in my reporting across the region in recent weeks. I think that's a generational change, right? That U.S. officials have been tracking and say are akin to the Iraq invasion, right? But now we're really seeing a whole new generation of people, especially after Trump, after his defeat, being told the U.S. is back, right? That was so much the Biden administration's message. The hope was built up a little bit, and it's come crashing down to an even lower point than before.
Let's talk about some of what President Biden put on the table last night. In fact, ahead of the speech, he allowed it to leak out that he wanted to put in a new port that would allow more aid to come in, that would allow more humanitarian supplies to come in. And he promised to do it with no boots on the ground, which sounds a little peculiar. I'm going to build a port and we're not going to have anybody over there. And the officials who were leaking that said, the U.S. military has unique capabilities that allow it to construct a port or causeway without having to send forces to Gaza's shore. That was as reported in Politico. How is word of that going over?
Look, Angie, I can tell you that I have a unique ability to sort of turn the sky purple, right? As someone who's been in Washington for three presidents, like, U.S. officials will make all sorts of huge claims. I think the proof is in the pudding, as you're saying. There's no one on the ground from the U.S. side, certainly. And the actual organization on the ground that knows how to do this, right, knows how to service the civilian needs of Gazans is the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, which the United States has stopped funding, right, based on increasingly dubious allegations of terror links. Other countries we've seen in recent weeks have said, you know what, we're not going to go with the US and Israel on this. The EU has pulled back their decision to halt funding. We've seen this from Canada now. So I think that idea is pitched on the premise of what we were referring to earlier, right? This kind of general maybe disconnection from the war. But I think for anyone who's tracking closely, including many former officials, including officials in the Biden administration, are saying this is not realistic, right? This is PR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go to the phones. A lot of people want to talk to you, Ahmed. Akbar. Let's bring on Dell, who's in Berkeley. She's right on point here. Hi, Dell.
Hi, how are you? I'm loving your show. I really appreciate this radio station, and I do believe that we need to keep funding you guys.
Thank you.
One of my major points is, it's so obvious, Israel is funneling their money into our government by influencing our elections, but it's easy for them to open up the border and let people through, but instead, we're going to add more money into Israel by building a pier. But mind you, Palestinians aren't even allowed to go fishing outside of that fishing area. What makes them believe that a boat is going to be allowed? Just recently, a boat from Switzerland, they got arrested trying to come into by the water. Filling so much money into Israel, and Biden is putting up this front like, oh, he's really trying to help, but if he was helping, he wouldn't be giving them money without the consent of the Senate. He's giving them weapons. This is so. Why isn't the media really shining a light on this? Because it's so obvious.
Dell, I really appreciate. Let's take some of that and take it to Akbar, because we're on two different points here, Akbar. One is that the continued sale of weapons is not a good thing in a case like this, and the second thing is whether this pier is practical at all.
Yeah, I think the continued flow of weapons is extremely interesting. I think, as Dell points out, he's not getting the consent of the Senate. He's bypassed Congress now twice to funnel an emergency aid to Israel. And I think, look, there's an argument to be made. There are many lawmakers who are supportive of military aid to Israel and say, look, they cannot be allowed to go through another attack like October 7th, lose so many people, so many hostages, truly horrific experience. But the question remains, number one, what are they doing with U.S. weaponry, right? And number two, I mean, to Dell's point, is the U.S. the one that has to pick up the check, right? So it's quite an interesting position to be put in for the U.S. And again, especially under a president who said he had learned from failed nation-building endeavors, for the U.S. to be both bombing and then paying to ameliorate the consequences of the bombing, right? It's tough for any taxpayer to think you're doing both sides of that.
Well, yeah.
I think it, what the Biden administration has said is, and I my sources within government are skeptical of this, but let's see if it happens. The Biden administration is saying, actually, we can get everyone else to pay for it. Right. So their argument is, we will help Israel defend itself, make them feel secure, and then the Saudis and a few other wealthy Arab states will kind of write us a blank check. Now, that's a huge assumption to make, right? And it comes back to also your boots on the ground point, because there's a lot of not open claims yet, but there's a lot of assumptions within Washington that they can cajole some of America's Arab partners to send troops in. I'd argue, and based on my reporting on the ground in the region, I can't see how any Arab government really wants to be closely associated with this U.S. policy yet. Because again, this is going to be an epochal generational tragedy.
Yes,
that we talked about.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a phone line open, one line at 866-798-8255. We have a few minutes left with Akbar Shahid Ahmed. He is with Huffington Post. And again, that's 866-798-8255. We're watching email too. Your call at KALW.org. Well, some of the extant aid is turning out to be problematic. We heard from the BBC right at the top of the hour that some of the airdrops actually killed people, where five people are dead now because of the airdrops. And it kind of makes you also think about the efficacy of the airdrops, the sheer volume of what they're able to do in the face of such great need. Are the airdrops making any significant difference? Do they move the needle at all in people starving and needing aid?
I think we cannot begin to imagine the desperation that people, especially in northern Gaza, are living in, right? Where they are cooking grass, they're cooking animal feed, they are forcing their children, right? Some parents are going without meals so that their children can have one meal a day. Water is extremely scarce. So from that point of view, if there's even a tiny modicum of something, perhaps it makes a difference. But what's so interesting, right? I talked earlier about UNRWA. It's not just them, whether it's Oxfam, whether it's Refugees International, whether it's smaller groups like ANIRA. There's a lot of aid workers who know how to do this distribution stuff. And what we've seen is, especially in the places where the need is greatest, interestingly, those are the places controlled by Israel, right? The U.S. ally. And aid convoys have not been able to get in. In many instances, the actual most effective distribution of aid, which is aid by land distributed by trained aid workers, they've been turned away by Israeli forces. So I think that question needs to be raised. And we've also seen reports as this floating peer aid ship. I'll try to rein in my disdain for a little bit, but it's just, I'm so used to hearing Washington speak, right, about ideas like this. As this floating magical pier full of aid happens, we've also seen leaks saying the Israelis are going to investigate opening one of their land routes. I mean, we're in month six of the war, right? Israel has controlled the most desperate part of Gaza now for nearly 3 months. It's pretty far in to be beginning to investigate the possibility of land distribution of aid.
Back to the phones. We're going to talk to Kim in San Francisco. Kim, we're tight for time. Can you keep it tight for me?
Yes, quickly. Just the boots on the ground issue. I think that's been said a lot. And I just can't understand how they can justify that by funding other people to put their children on just because your child is not going to war. How does that get justified? And you're paying for somebody else to go to war.
That's interesting. So what do you think in terms, Akbar, of whether no boots on the ground that belong to us may not translate to boots on the ground belonging to some other country?
Right. I mean, I think there's not a desire, right? I think, again, given the need, this should not be a political question, but it is. And the president is potentially on his way out of office. I don't think that even other countries are willing to risk, as you're saying, their children, their people, to be on the ground in Gaza for a historically unpopular president with a deeply unpopular policy who may not be in office this time next year. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, to be honest.
Well, we're obviously looking at a deeply tragic, horrific situation, and there's no immediate end in sight. So let me ask you, in the spirit of our media roundtable, at a time like this, what press are you relying on where you can get timely, accurate information on the assaults in Gaza?
Oh, I really like that question, because I ask people that question all the time. I mean, I think everyone should read HuffPost. I am very fortunate to work with some really talented editors and colleagues, so please read us. We have round-the-clock coverage. The BBC is a great source. Some of my colleagues on the ground from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, are doing really interesting work. And then I just recommend people kind of take it with a pinch of salt, but do try to read the local outlets, right? Like Haaretz, the Israeli liberal paper of record, is incredible. I began to subscribe to them since the onset of this war because they need shoring up, right? And they are pressing their own government in a way that's really challenging and frankly did not happen in this country after 9/11, right? So Haaretz in Israel, really worth it. Al Jazeera, from sort of the Arab world and perspective, also really worth it. I would also just put in a little sort of pitch from a journalist. I do feel that there's so much interest in this in social media and platforms that are not so vetted and not run by professionals. And I just hope folks reading that stuff do kind of try to go back to a strong base of information, you know, before kind of taking... Well, for instance, I've seen a lot of people raise this idea that Biden has already approved $14 billion in additional aid for Israel. I think that line has gone a lot on social media. He's proposed it. It has not been passed by Congress. It has not been signed into law. And if you ask me today, I think it's pretty unlikely it will be. He did propose it. But, you know, that's one of these misunderstandings, I think. So I do recommend.
That's great guidance because, I mean, you can find something on social media, but be your own journalist and go check it out. Make sure it's actually a fact before you go retweeting or reskeeting or whatever it is that you're going to do. So,
100%.
Akbar, thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed works out of Washington, D.C. for the Huffington Post, where he is the senior diplomatic correspondent. Thank you so much for tuning into your call today, and we've appreciated your phone calls as well. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. We are on iTunes, where you can find us and give us a review. Follow us on X, Your Call Radio, and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malia Hayraz is on produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Rose is out today. She'll be back shortly. I'm Angie Coiro sitting in. This is Your Call.